under preferences.
I don't know if that was a blip to start because I started and stopped and now I'm starting again, but that's the way it goes here at Rhetoric Warriors, the podcast where we are straightening out the words of the world because they're all bent and crooked coming at you in weird ways. I'm Dr. Dan, rhetorician, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors, where we talk to comedians about their careers and their politics and we let them do whatever they want because this is the no censorship zone. And then I get in trouble. Like I have one guy that did stuff and I'm like, I don't know. I also bring on people from far away political viewpoints that typically means conservatives. And I try to convert them. I think that's fun. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians. Podcast has more rhetoricians than any podcast you're going to hear today. This is another episode of Persuasion Pros, where I find people out there doing rhetoric work. They're just not calling it rhetoric work. They're de facto rhetoricians and don't know it. My guest today is a persuasion pro who does some really interesting stuff. We met on Lunch Club, which is like, how modern is that? We met on Lunch Club and now we're doing a podcast together. I love people who have niche expertise. I saw a lot of this in Hollywood where people do something incredibly well. They focus in on one thing, do incredibly well. And then Hollywood makes teams of those super experts and in theory creates super product in theory. So this guy since 2014 has run Podcast Junkies and has a deep expertise in the podcast world, has a business selling podcasts for businesses. So welcome podcast strategist, Harry Duran.
Hey, Dan, thank you so much for having me on the show. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Here's one of the reasons why I was never, like I was a writer and a producer. I even did director, all that behind the scenes stuff. My problem with being in front of the camera or the microphone is I have a Kentucky mouth. Like I was raised for 18 years in Kentucky and it just garbles. I can't help it. Anytime I try to get speed or energy into my voice.
Or open your mouth wider and articulate your words.
Yeah.
I feel you because my partner tells me all the time that I mumble a lot. It doesn't sound like a mumble to me, but
it's interesting. Yeah, you're soft spoken.
Yeah.
But you sound like a, you know, kind of a mellow, I don't know, one of those sleep guys.
Oh yeah. There's one of my previous guests, Drew Ackerman, his podcast is called Sleep No More, I think. Oh, no. Yeah, something like that. But his whole thing is he reads like really dry content and he reads it in a really monotone voice. And the whole point is by the time the podcast is over, you'll be asleep. And people listen to it to go to sleep.
I'm sure they do. You really do have a really mellow voice. I bet you could do that voice work.
But what's funny is that he now does live shows and people come and they dress up and they bring their pajamas and they bring their blankets and pillows and he does live readings of the podcast. And obviously people are out by the time it's over.
That is awesome.
Gets paid to drone.
I don't know if you've ever been to a planetarium.
Yeah.
You want to see people sleeping. Like they're leaning back in their chair so they can see the ceiling. And there's somebody, again, you know, droning on about science. And man, it's like 50% of the audience is out.
Yeah. Yeah, it was years ago, but shout out to the Hayden Planetarium. Oh, no, not the Hayden Planetarium. Is that the one in New York City now? I forgot.
You got me. I've not kept up with my planetarium since my,
school trips.
Yeah. So, well, cool. So orient people a little bit to Harry Duran and the podcast junkie experience.
So when people ask for the origin story, I tell them it goes all the way back to growing up as a DJ, vinyl, turntables. And that was a passion for me since I saw someone do that the first time at a party. And I'm like, whoa, that guy is controlling the energy of the entire room. And it's pretty fascinating. So it helped that I fell in love with the music, house music, and I was off and running. Was doing that for high school parties.
And you were in Queens, you said before. Like that was like you were right, or Was it
Yonkers,
Queens?
Yonkers, New York, and then I've actually lived in Brooklyn and Manhattan as well. So
you've been, I mean, right at the core of the birth of all that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I remember one of the first rap songs I heard, and I was like, they're speaking so fast. I can barely understand like what they're saying, because it's just not like anything you've heard before. And now my go-to song on karaoke night is Rapper's Delight. So
that's great. So, I had a neighbor in LA who was a recording producer, recording engineer, and had worked with tons of different people. And two things about him were interesting. One was when you walked into his condo, he had a massive, like 6-foot white buffalo hanging in one corner, stuffed white buffalo. And I'm like, what's that? And he's like, it's the perfect thing for absorbing this particular kind of sound wave. I'm like, okay, recording engineer. And the second thing was, he was there when rap started, and he told his buddies, like, well, this is the end of us. Like, they're not even singing. This is spoken word.
Yeah. It comes full circle. They do collaborations now, and it just keeps evolving. And it's so funny, because I'll listen to stuff now, like trap, like, and I'm just like, I feel old, and I'm just like, I don't get it. Or like mumble rap is a genre now as well. So, I mean, I think every generation has that moment when you just don't quite get the music of the current generation, and you feel even silly like saying that out loud.
Yeah, you've got it. All art is that way, though, right? It's all working off what just came before it. And so if you don't know the progression, it just looks stupid. It's like when, what's the guy's name, Duchamp or whatever, who had the toilet just sitting in the Met or the MoMA. It's like, people are like, what's that? He's like, that's the perfect next step in art.
Yeah, I went to the Museum of, is it the Modern Art Museum or the New Museum? One of those in New York City years ago. And I remember going into one of the rooms, and there was a mattress just like stuck against the wall. And I'm just like, okay, you know.
Somebody recently duct taped something to the wall. Was it a hot dog? Something. It's like, there's your art.
Well, NFT is the natural progression of that, right?
Yeah. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen the documentary, The Value of Everything. I think that's the name of it. They talk about how they pimp up the prices for art, how it all, you know, becomes a market of its own, mm-hmm. you know, that it, none of it has value really, but suddenly it's worth $100 million.
Yeah.
Because it's worth $100 million.
Someone said it is. I would say that we should put a price on this podcast episode.
$100 million. We're taking bids.
Your first NFT is going to be this episode.
Yeah.
So, back to the electronic music. I started a mobile app with a friend of mine, because I was going to festivals, and I wanted to keep track of who was playing and keep track of my favorite DJs. So we built it together, started marketing it. It was called Know Your DJ. And incidentally enough, like, the people who managed the .dj domain name don't do a really good job of keeping up with the payments, because I haven't paid for it in a while. But if you go to knowyour.dj in a browser, you'll see the app there. It's still there. And fun fact, .dj is the country code for the country of Djibouti.
That's my favorite. One of my favorite things about when people resist globalism and want to stay, you know, in the conservative past. I'm like, there's 195 countries in the world. Like, you know, like 7, and you don't like those. What happens? So it's, yeah.
Djibouti. It's just fun to say. I thought I wanted to interview DJs to promote the app. So there's a popular website called Resident Advisor, where you can get updates on all the happenings in electronic music, and they had a show, and that was the first time I heard people talking on a podcast. Before then, for me, a podcast was a DJ set, like a 60-minute set. You'd mix tracks together and you'd put it on SoundCloud, and I'm like, oh, that's a podcast. And then as I was creating the app, I was looking and finding a podcast about mobile apps, a podcast about digital marketing. I was like, oh, this is cool. So I went to a conference called New Media Expo in Las Vegas in 2014. And probably dating itself, the three topics they were going to cover were YouTube, blogging, and podcasting.
Nice.
So I went, and I saw some folks that I've actually became friends with after the fact, but people that are known in the podcasting space, like Pat Flynn, Amy Porterfield, and I watched their sessions, and I was like, this is interesting. I also studied acting when I was in New York, so I was familiar with that TV show Inside the Actor Studio, right? And I was like, this is cool. You get to know about the actor, but like not like as a real person. So that was floating in my head, and I was like, what about a show like that, but a podcast where I interview podcasters about podcasting? So, and then, yeah, just to hear what motivated them, what got them started. But I feel, looking back, I had an ulterior motive because I wanted to make inroads into the podcasting industry. I didn't know a lot of people. I knew someone from a course I took online. But other than that, I said, what's the best way to like introduce myself and say, hey, I'm Harry. I want to learn about you. And we had hour-long conversations. And we used video. And it wasn't Zoom at the time. It was Skype with call recorder. You'd have to mix those two together. And I could see them. And then I would just use the audio. So similar to what a lot of people do now.
You know, we're kind of at a meta level. I'm interviewing you about you interviewing podcasters about podcasts. So it's a podcast three times removed from the original act of making a podcast.
Yeah, it is pretty interesting. And then,
so if anybody'd like to interview us about this podcast,
this experience, yeah. And then make an NFT about that as well. So yeah, I'm still, it's one of those things. I feel like there's a lot of tangents we just break off on, but the NFT thing is interesting because I feel like I got to do it once and just create one just so I know how it works. And so that's in the works as well.
The whole you have to, right? Why not? I mean, it's the concept of value that you get some control over. Like you can create value and sell it out of nothing.
Yeah.
That's pretty. That's like printing money. That's like counterfeiters.
Yeah. And I think it's just a function. When people figure it out, I feel like all the money is just changing hands between the people that have no better place to put their money.
Yeah. Well, there's that.
So I came back and I started the show Podcast Junkies. I started the interviews, but I also realized I didn't know a lot about digital marketing. I mean, I was in corporate for almost 20 years. I worked at JP Morgan Chase and E-Trade and in their marketing departments, and did some consulting, but you don't learn entrepreneurism. You don't learn, all the stuff you need to do, just even some websites, how to pay taxes,
right?
Little stuff like that. So I hired a business coach, learned a lot about that stuff. And then a year into that, I realized these business owners were paying this guy like $1,500 a month for his IP, you know, just stuff in his head. Like he was teaching them frameworks on how to do he teaches one-to-many coaching. So he helps one-to-one coaches move to like a scaled product. So it was just a whole new world. And these are like 6 and 7 figure businesses. And I was like, whoa. So they understand opportunity cost. They know what an hour of their time is worth. What if I created, and if they're interested in podcasting, then I'll just create a, you know, premium priced offer. And I'll just bundle it as a done for you service. And I had someone actually in the group, you know, about a year in, saw me posting, writing something on a whiteboard in one of the live sessions. And he's like, oh, that's an interesting offer you have there. When it's ready, let me know. I want to start my show. And I got home that weekend. He called me. He's like, yeah, I'm ready. He's like, how much is it? And I was like, I sent him my PayPal link and I was off and running.
Yeah. So I've done a ton of ghostwriting for people over the years. I mean, I've basically been paid to ghostwrite jokes for people for the last 4 decades, starting with stand-ups. When I first started as a stand-up in my early 20s, if somebody's a really good stand-up, if they have a really good character, for writers, their voice will just start bouncing around in your head. Like just this afternoon, there's a friend of mine named Kirk Miller from Kentucky, and he sounds so Kentucky. He's super smart, nice guy, but has a certain look. And I just think of him as Kentucky Kirk. And I just sent him a bunch of material about bourbon because he had written something on his Facebook that said, I can't remember what the original line was, but I'm like, the angle M was that he's sort of like bourbon. It's like, he's so Kentucky that like he's a bit of a wild turkey. He he's smooth, but he's got a bite. And I just ended up writing 10 minutes of stand-up for him.
Nice.
About bourbon. And it was super fun, you know, because again, that voice starts bouncing around my head. And I just want to infuse it into the world somehow.
What triggered that thought?
You were talking about, I was just wondering that myself. I'm like, why am I in this? Where was I going?
It had I talked about how I was, because of the podcasting and getting the coach, and then I started the agency because I saw what all these business owners were doing. So I was creating a done for you service.
Oh, no, what it is, the turnkey aspect of podcast. So when you look at doing a turnkey product for people, there's a lot of things that people would put into the world if they had the turnkey ability. So like you, and we've talked about this a little bit, you have a podcast expertise, you understand a lot of the technology, the business side, sponsorships, all that. Whereas the talent coming in usually just knows one little thing and they can't do the array that would bring it to life. So even with me doing my podcast, I have a tech partner who kind of understands podcasts. He understands tech, but he's made some wrong choices about what I've got going, and you've pointed them out. So that turnkeyness, I think, is a really good offer for people who are talented in the world and they've got content, but they don't know what to do with it. They don't know how to go beyond that.
Yeah. And I think they underestimate all the moving parts for it to be done correctly and the right way, like with any endeavor. When I first got started, I, like everyone else, going down YouTube rabbit holes and like, what's the best mic? And then if you're an overthinker or you like every T crossed and I dotted, then you'll have your list of mics, possible mics to buy, possible hosting companies. And in 2014, the choices were a little easier. Now it's just overwhelming, and people get sort of deer in the headlights, or they just go with the easiest way to start. Let's just go to Anchor and just start a free show and just record from your phone. And a lot of times that's helpful because you may not know what you want to talk about. And so people that are just dipping their toe in the water, jump on Anchor, start your show, have at it. If you can be consistent, then more power to you. And that just shows you'll have at least some staying power. But you may just realize it's not for you. While people like to quote the 2 million podcasts and the Apple Podcast Directory number, the reality is about maybe 400,000 of them are like active. And that's just with more than one episode. There's a whole graveyard of dead episodes, of dead podcasts in Anchor, because it's the barrier to entry is so low. And in podcasting is actually a term called pod fading. If you haven't made it past episode 7, you've pod faded. So,
well, this is no different, really. So when you talk about doing a turnkey product for a podcast, maybe people think it's not that big a deal because it's just audio, right? And the tech has gotten to the point where you can, in some ways, use somebody's software or their app and get to a general product pretty quickly. But I tell people this all the time, like if you saw everything going on behind the scenes at a Hollywood production, from the moment it was conceived to the moment it gets to the audience, you would be so blown away by how many people are working on how many moving parts. Even in the podcast world, because I've produced a few podcasts as an executive creative producer, but just the fact that, like, how do you write questions? Are you expecting your brain to just come up with good questions in the moment? Well, then you need a talent that knows how to improvise and have good conversations. And not everybody does. You know, sometimes they have a great voice and they're good monologue, they're good actors, but they can't have a dialogue to save their life. And I saw that a lot on talk shows. So so let's break this down a little bit. When you talk about turnkeying a podcast, do you start with tech? Or do you start with expertise? Like, what's their content that they want to talk about? What do you start with?
Yeah, I usually tell folks when we're getting started that we assume you're starting at zero. So that literally means you have no idea what you want to talk about. You don't even know the name of the show. And we really want to think about that strategically. I just recommend a book that I just finished called Make Noise, and it's by Eric Newsom. He used to work at NPR. He's worked at Audible. There's no shortage of books about podcasting, but he comes at it from like a lot of experience in the industry and just really thinking through these things almost as a consultant would and working with clients. So it's important to think about the very basics. Like, what are you going to name the show? Are you using SEO best practices? Like, don't call it like the Cool Guys Marketing Show. Like, nobody's searching for that. So just really thinking about naming, because you need four things in order to submit a show to Apple. You'll need a title, you'll need a description, you'll need cover art, and then you'll need your first piece of audio. And the name and the description, you know, people want to know what it is that they're getting into when they just by the name of the show. And I started the second show in vertical farming. I called it Vertical Farming Podcast. It's pretty explanatory what the show's about, because there's so much competition. So people should have an inkling of what they're going to get from the title, the
description. Right. So what do you drive? And I run into this all the time in my marketing agency, because I'm the creative side. My partner's the SEO side. He's like, name it for the SEO. I'm like, well, then it's a horrible title creatively. Like, there's nothing interesting in that title. And so you get this dual pressure, and that's why naming is so hard. When you really nail a name for a business on a product or the business itself these days, it does both instantly. It's SEO searchable, like within the groove that people type in to their computers. And it's also cool. There's something fun in it and interesting in it. And that's the nirvana when you can find something like that that serves both those masters. But which do you choose? Like, you chose the SEO one, vertical marketing.
Vertical farming. Yeah. Because I didn't have any, this is interesting because it's, if I don't have any insight or relationship to that market or that industry, or no, like, I was nobody in that space. And the show has since ranked number one in several countries in for podcasting, because I would play around with the categories, because you can pick three categories. And we got it to rank like number one as, I think, Kenya and like three or four other countries, and like top 10 or at least top 50 or top 100 and like a dozen others. So it's, you do have to like game the SEO a little bit, but I just wanted to get as much traffic to it. And my process there was interviewing CEOs and founders. So not only would you see the name of the show, but you would recognize those names that I have in my show, because they're just like the people who are running some of the biggest companies in the space. So that's some of the stuff we think about in the beginning. There is guidance on equipment. Just for example, I know people are listening right now, but right now, if you're just listening, you just hear my voice far away from the microphone. And for the benefit of the listener, I just brought it back closer. And these are just like the little tips and tricks you need to learn about how to position a mic. Plosive P's, like, that's why I usually tend to speak across the mic as well. There's people that, you know, it's not American Idol, so you're not like singing into the mic directly. So just all these things that people who are not comfortable recording on a regular basis would need to learn about. So we do a lot of hand-holding in the beginning, help them set up their scheduling. So it's easy and seamless for guests to book time on their show. We want to capture all the information we need ahead of time, the headshots, all the socials, because we do all the promo for them. So it's really thinking about what's going to happen on their website when the show's available. Where are you going to send people to? What's your music going to be? What's your intro? Like, what's the show intro?
Amount of decision making. And this is also like, again, I've done tons of work now with clients that have zero background in marketing or message production. And somehow they're still in charge of the decisions, you know, the executives. And you can see it. I very quickly get them to the point where I make this offer, where I'm like, so are you tired of making decisions you're unqualified to make?
That's a great one.
So just let me do it. You know, I'll run something by you. So if you see something crazy that you can't handle, then fine. But there are 500 decisions to make this week. So do you want me to check in with you on every one of them? Or do you want to hand it off? And they always want to hand it off because they are the least qualified person in the room to make the decision. They still want the credit for when it works, which is fine. That's what they're paying me for. But getting what I sometimes label as dysfunctionals, not in a bad way, it's just you are not functional in this job, in this space. Get them out of the process so that the hyper-functionals can do the work that you need them to do.
Yeah, it's interesting. Way to explain it. I love that line, and I'm going to find a way to use that in a future discussion. One of the ways my coach explained it to me is like, there's four types of tasks. Those you're incompetent at, those you're competent at, those you're excellent at, and then you're genius. And obviously the first two, you get off your plate as soon as possible. You know, things like having a housekeeper come to your house and clean your house. but the excellent ones are the things that you get, you've got a pretty good expertise, maybe even like studied this topic. And you know it very, very well, but you're not a master at it, or it's not your genius. And so for me, it was like web design stuff. And I remember the first time I asked somebody to help me with like something in the sidebar of my website. You would think it's something that take like 10 minutes. 6 hours later, I'm still trying to figure it out. It's just like, this is not working. And I just reached out to a friend. He like within 5 minutes, maybe fixed it so quick. And I was like, oh, okay, that's your genius. That's what you do. That's like, and why you do it, and why you get paid, and why you get paid a full hour for something you can get done in 5 minutes.
Yeah, because it would take you 6 hours. And so if it takes him 5 minutes, awesome. Yeah. You both come out ahead. It's a bizarre process. Again, when I leaving Hollywood and going outside, even in stand-up's an interesting, almost non-professionalized form of entertainment, in that the stand-ups are not used to working with other people. They're not used to working with teams. They're not using writers and directors and executives and all this stuff. And so they end up handicapping themselves in Hollywood, because when you go out there, nothing gets done without 100 people being involved, and they can't work with people. They're like, and I'm like, no, you have to pull their expertise. They'll make things so much better than you could ever make them. You just do what you're good at and leave everything else to the executive producer to control. And if they can do it, they're fine. But like the guy I was talking about earlier, Kirk, Kentucky Kirk, I want to name him Kentucky Kirk and the Red State Ramblers, because he's a musician. He sings, he makes his own instruments. This guy's lived in Kentucky for almost 60 years. Super funny. And he's resisting me. He wants to use his name, Kirk Miller. I'm like, that means nothing to anyone ever, anywhere. You could live in, you know, Scotland and be Kirk Miller, you know, but Kentucky Kirk. Okay. You know.
And I mean, that the band cover art already like paints itself. I mean, I'm visually just seeing it. There's some like red in there and some like swirls, and yeah, it's definitely much, much better.
Yeah. And it's like a Stephen Colbert ironic appropriation of the right, you know, and red statism. So he can sing songs that, you know, tweak them and tease them and stuff, even though it sounds like he's on their side.
It sounds like a honey trap.
Yeah, that's about right. So it should be super fun. I just, now you got to work with the talent to get them to accept the good ideas instead of their ideas.
Well, I think the genius is when you make them feel like it was their idea.
Yeah, but that's so much work. I prefer to just dominate them and tell them, you look, do it or you're fired. It's much better that way.
Do you find a certain type of personality responds better to that type of direction?
No personality stunt really reacts well to that direction. Turns out human beings don't like to be dominated.
Yeah.
No, there's a lot of hand-holding and a lot of psychology when you do this kind of work of turnkeying or even, you know, contributing to things for people. So when I hear you say things like you're going to turnkey a podcast for a business, and then you start to split it out of all the things, technical, marketing, creative, psychological, all these different things that you're managing, it's a big offer.
Yeah. And it's funny. Sometimes some people come to us and they're like, we've got a guy who can do a little bit of editing. We've got someone who can do some of the artwork. I'm like, okay, let's try it that way first.
Yeah.
You know, like a couple months later, just like, yeah, it's a lot. I'm like, yeah. And I've had people like leave and they go to like another agency and they come back and like, yeah, it turns out you were doing a lot for us. I was like, yeah.
Yeah. Turns out.
Yeah. So it was good.
There's that education factor as a business that you've got to get people to realize just how valuable what you're doing is to them, you know. And again, I think I like the pitch of turnkey. Sometimes I want an infographic in front of them and go, hey, when I say turnkey, check this out. These are all the things you're buying for $2K a month. And then it's a pretty good offer.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, just letting people know, like I said, our, you know, our program started at $2K a month, and then it goes from there depending on how much else you need. But it feels like it just very quickly can filter out the tire kickers, and the people are just like, oh, okay, I thought this was gonna be like a $50 a month thing. Just never mind. I'm like, yeah, I can direct you to a ton of free resources. And like I said, the stuff that I'm telling people and that we're doing for them, it's not like secret sauce stuff. It's not like rocket science. It's like you could figure it out. Like, it's a lot of people do this. The question is like, how much time do you have and how quickly do you want to get the show up and how much time do you want to spend on it every week?
Yeah. And how many mistakes do you want to make, like recording your Zoom locally on a hard drive so that you lose the first episode of interviewing a guy about podcast junkies, which if you weren't aware, you wouldn't be, because I didn't say it, but this is the second time we've done this interview, because I lost the first one.
It's always better second time around.
Yeah. You know, it's all, we're in sync now, man. We're yeah, like a team.
And we also remind clients that we work with that the offers also has consulting built into it, because I used to try to price it out separately, but I'm like, I realize every single client needs a little bit of handholding, but in different things. And some may just need more coaching on interview techniques, or to your point, asking better questions or asking more thoughtful questions, or some may need help with like the scheduling component of it. So there's little pieces and people have different expertise and strengths, but I think reminding people that it's a conversation that has to be engaging, especially for podcasts, since they're consumed on audio. They're intimate mediums, and it's a bit cliche sometimes in the podcasting space, but people are consuming them on more likely than not earbuds, right? And it's literally me talking into your phone, the listener that's listening to this episode
Like if we were next to your ear right now in the real world going, hey, man, you want to hear about podcasts?
This is going to be so good. You're going to blow your mind.
How long would you let us do that? An hour? An hour and 15 minutes? Hey, how's it going? How's it going in there?
It's just me, you, and Dan. Three of us.
Harry's going to take your left ear. I'm going to have your right ear. And we are going to, man, are we going to teach you about podcasts?
Well, if you send me, too bad you don't do too much post-production, because if you get me the audio back, I'm so tempted on this episode to actually pan so the listeners gets like totally messed up and disoriented. Not that this is what we want to do, but I remind people, this is a three-way conversation. There's a host, there's a guest, and there's a listener. Like, you don't have a podcast if there's nobody listening. Right. And so remembering that there's that dynamic happening, and it's the analogy of pulling into a bar and seeing two people speaking, and you pull up next to them and you're like, hey, what are you guys talking about? And there's that awkward couple of seconds where are they going to invite me to the conversation or not? And then when they don't, you just like moonwalk out of there and just like, yeah, it's okay. I'm going to go over here.
It is. I want to talk some, because I think, you know, we're putting out your offer pretty well, a pretty good description of what a business gets when they do this. And I also want to talk about, you know, what they should expect from like an ROI from this, like what does a good podcast do? But before we get to that, take it up a level to the abstract nature of podcasts. Because you, like you said, this is supposedly two of us talking to one person who's listening on earbuds. But right now you and I are talking to no one. We are talking to an imaginary person in the future, which is odd. That is an odd form of communication.
It is. It is interesting, and just doing it for so many years, I'm just conscious of how you have to be thinking ahead of how the audio that we're creating is going to be consumed. And it is funny because if we're talking about an imaginary listener, that when you hear this is some dimensional time travel stuff happening now, but like when the listener's listening to this, you're hearing my voice now, and thanks for listening and subscribing to Dan's show. That audio was recorded at a moment when you weren't listening.
Yeah. So you didn't exist yet. Like we are predicting your existence.
But that's what separates the good shows from the great shows, from the mediocre shows, when you feel like that immersed in what's happening and you're creating this dynamic multimedia event and understanding the play of like how it's being consumed now. I need to be conscious of how we're interacting, right? So there's something that's happening between you and I and a back and forth with these questions and answers and this conversation. And then that next level of like, oh, what's going to happen next? And it gets really interesting. And I find it fascinating because I know when I've heard it done well, and I feel pulled into a conversation. Time flies. I'm like, wow, that was really awesome. And they don't know that I was listening.
Right.
But I got so much out of it.
But you weren't listening. You're listening to a recording that happened from the past. As a rhetorician, as somebody that studies messaging being put out into the world and what makes it work and what holds it back, it is fascinating to me. I have a big dual background in information work as a professor and a rhetoric PhD. And then I have a big background in entertainment work as a stand-up comic and a comedy writer. And I'm aware of both of those machines going on in my head. Like, I'm like, hey, get a joke in here, you know, and it's kind of who I am anyway. So it's not just an artificial inner director saying, not enough jokes, man.
He's knocking on the window of from the recording room, be like, yeah,
screaming at the window, where's my jokes? But more then joke, on the other side, as a previous academic, and I have academics on here, just the pressure to do really good information when I talk to academics is there. So, but then like you're talking about the person in the future who I'm talking to doesn't know 2,500 years of rhetorical theory. So I can't leave them behind. So it is, there's a lot of forces at work in this moment.
Yeah. Interviewing subject matter experts or, people who are super well-educated is interesting and challenging because you get to start down a rabbit hole of like terms and just phrases that the average listener wouldn't know about. And you have to be conscious. If that's the type of show you're going to have, you're going to invite scientists on, you better be prepared to say, what does that mean? Or can you explain that? Otherwise, it's again, you're just going to lose the listener. And I think it's just an interesting exercise. I've been thinking more about on my show that just calling them conversations instead of interviews and thinking of my guests as co-hosts.
Yeah, I like conversations. I think conversation is a God word for most of the world. I sometimes describe these as just trying to have a really stimulating conversation. If you feel it flag at all, and I also have a background in communication studies that it's not rhetoric, but it's the human art of communication. And I love studying conversation. Like it's one of my favorite things to write about and study because like turn taking in these things, if you hold the turn too long and you're not giving really good information, you will lose listeners because they're like, this is going on too long. It's a little tiny monologue. Whereas in dialectical and dialogic communication, you're constantly handing the turn back, right?
Is that the talking stick?
Yeah, it would be, but it's done. It's done with meta signaling. So it's done with paralanguage, which is, about your vocalics, it's your volume and your tone and all that. And it's done with nonverbals. Yeah. So if I'm about ready to finish a turn, I signal it.
Yeah.
Like that.
By leaning forward. It's an interesting topic because I'm conscious of it. And what happens is in the beginning, sometimes podcasters, and just speaking as podcasters, because that's been my focus, is you have to be careful if you're not well versed in that to ask a question that's or just end a sentence thinking like, hey, we're just gonna wrap off each other and you're gonna like pick up where I left off, right? But if it's not done well and if it's not there's not a conscious understanding that something has to happen, so like that lean forward or just a gesture with the hands, which that's another benefit of doing video, if that doesn't happen, sometimes you're just like, yeah, and that's why, I ran away from home myself, and then you just trail off, and then the guest is like left, like, am I supposed to comment on that, or am I supposed to like have an opinion? So I'm conscious of it, and I try to make sure I'm asking a specific question of them, just so I'm covering my bases. The beauty is that we do edit a lot of the shows we produce for clients, so even if there is that awkward silence, we'll leave
all awkwardness, all failure, and because I'm not going to come back and touch this. I got too many other things I want to do.
But there is that. It's described as the theater of the mind as well. Like you're envisioning what's happening, and sometimes with the audio drama podcast, they do a really good job of that because you're just like, whoa,
oh, it's incredible.
And they're using the spatial audio now. Like Dolby's got this new stuff, and I may have mentioned to you last time we spoke, but just. I was walking down the street and there was a sound of something hammering something. And I literally turned my head and I was like, oh, it was in the show. it was in the, and I only had earbuds on, no fancy stuff. And I think what you can do now is pretty interesting because then it puts you really immerses you in the experience.
Yeah. When production quality and production technique takes those steps up and then you match it with good content, again, coming from Hollywood, I'm completely amazed and spoiled by how well they do all this stuff. Like I used to be able to go into an edit bay. There were two full-time edit bays when I worked at Fox, two avids and two avid editors there at all times. And you book 10 minutes and they had access to every Getty image, every piece of video. They had all these feeds. And within, a half hour, we could cut a 6-7 minute TV ready sketch, or segment. And it's just perfect. And you're used to sitting there with somebody who's got that speed and that kind of skill and that access to those resources. And then you walk out into the world and you're like, I want to do this on my own. And you're like, oh, I can't do this on my own.
The tools are getting really, really good. And I did a little bit of audio electronic music production. And so I learned a tool called Ableton Live and Logic Pro to do mastering. And so they're overkill if you're going to do podcasting, because I always make the joke that using Ableton Live to edit your podcast is like taking your Ferrari to the grocery store. It's just, you can do it. But
I do that a lot, actually. I take both, one of my Ferraris goes to the grocery store, and the other one I take to the hardware store.
Yeah. And but I, now I use this book called Hindenburg, talk about branding. There's a story there. Like, name your product about one of the biggest disasters in the history of
it's named Hindenburg.
Hindenburg, yeah, it's a
I
really
love
good,
it. But I don't care what it is, I love it.
The story is the Hindenburg disaster was the first time of a live broadcast of a some sort of major event, and so that's what's known in the radio industry as a major event, and that's why a tribute to that.
I actually have stand-up material about the Hindenburg. Just like, just imagine that morning where, you know, like the captain was walking and like talking to the crew mechanics, and he's like, "Is this thing ready to go?" Like, "Yeah, we're just going to fill it up with helium here, and we'll be ready." He's like, "Nah, go with hydrogen." Like, "Sure, man. I think that stuff explodes." "Nah, look, hydrogen. That's what we're all about."
What's the worst that can happen?
What could go wrong? Who's gonna come on? What's it going to do? Blow up?
I feel like, and obviously enough time has passed with that one, but that just makes me think of like the line too soon, right? When people are just like, and comics and comedians are known to like, just keep testing. Like how soon is too soon for something? And I'm sure most comedians will probably test it the very next day. Just
yeah. I've seen yeah. people do it the same day. Yeah. Like go up that night, you know, when a tragedy hits, it depends on the tragedy. Deaths are hard, you know, usually, you know, there's all sorts of weird things. And the character, there's a guy named Roger Rittenhouse, a great stand-up comic, really great writer, and he's missing a right hand, so he has a metal hook. Like, he didn't get a prosthetic, maybe he has now, this is years ago, but he had just the two finger metal hook. And he had some great one-liners jokes, like when I was a kid, because I've had this forever, so I, you know, went out Halloween like this, and no matter what you go out as, if you've got a metal hand, you're a pirate.
It's true.
It's like, ah, yeah. Oh, look at that pirate dressed up like Groucho Marx. And like he would do like really harsh joke. Guy could write a dark joke, and if people would balk, he'd be like, "Hey, I got a hook."
It's good.
Get out of free card. Get out of jail free card.
Is he still performing?
I don't know if he is or not. I know he's still around. I'm friends with him on Facebook. I may try to pull him on a podcast because he's just an artist with that type of stuff. And as a rhetorician, it lets you, like, you literally realize you can say whatever if you have the right legitimacy of some type of, you know, character. Like, if you have the right legitimacy built into your character, you can say whatever you want about certain things.
My stage name is going to be Captain Inappropriate.
There you go. Captain Inappropriate. I like
Do you think actively, or whatever the proper adverb there is, but about your shows over time, your episodes over time, or are you just, you're just capturing moments in time? Do you ever think of it on the whole of like the podcast itself, the 30, 40, or however many episodes? I think, you know, you're way beyond that.
78.
Yeah, 78. So like, do you feel like you're getting better, or is it something you're thinking about?
Yeah, I think it's clearly better. It's faster. It's denser. It's moves around, I think, the space more adeptly. I know how to get people to talk about their stuff and sort of pull their topics out of them. One thing I've noticed as I've gone on is that pulling out subtopics is really useful. Like, even this, like, you know, the fact that you work for business and podcasts. So if I'm really deep diving into this to find out that information, I want to know, well, tell me what a business gets from this, which, let's jump into that. So why would a business want to do a podcast? Because businesses, so much of their content is just actually it's marketing. It's just called content. They're not really giving anything of value. It's not really entertaining. I'm like, hey, quit making commercials that you think are funny, because they're not, you know, Liberty Mutual and your stupid ostrich. So you tell me, like, what is a business? What is the aesthetic a business needs to hit? Do they need to be giving out really useful information and doing real entertainment? Or are they okay with just this kind of faux, hey, we got a podcast, we're cool?
Great question. As an aside, I think there's some sort of competition going on with all the insurance companies. They're trying after Flo and Geico obviously was the start of it, but that's like every insurance company now has to be like smart and witty. It's
Yeah,
crazy.
they're all like, hey, what is this, a comedy club or an insurance agency? Because I've seen enough lizards and camels and, you know.
Yeah, and what's the one with the red shirt, State Farm?
Oh, that's the worst. They are the worst. They make the worst commercials. Like, hire some comedians, please. You're killing me.
But it's so funny because it's all like insurance companies doing it, which is interesting.
Well, most rhetoric, this is again why, like, when I got into marketing, most marketing is just replicating standard practice. They see something works, they copy it. And that's not rhetoric. Rhetoric thinks about it. It's like, hey, someone else is already using this. We need to twist this somehow. Okay, well, let's use an emu. Well, nobody's used an emu. Like, I get it, but you probably need more of a twist than that. But anyway, yes, marketing agencies and that kind of stuff. Standard practices is a really strong aesthetic.
Yeah, well, and hats off to Geico for being so long standing. I mean, I think I was thinking about seeing those commercials probably 20 years ago. So, kudos to them to keep reinventing themselves.
Yeah, they knew some things like their rhetorical strategies about singularity, repeating the same message over and over again,
Yeah.
using real humor,
Yeah.
using original characters, using good talent. Like, that's great talent on those voices. And there's
Yeah.
actually some decent writing in those commercials.
Yeah.
And then it's just saturation. They have spent, I don't know how many billions of dollars, but 20 years ago, nobody had ever heard of Geico. And now, who hasn't?
Yeah. And I loved it when the YouTube ads first came out and they were only 8 seconds before you would hit the next button. So they created an 8 second commercial, which is like blew my mind. And they got me sucked in so much that I would keep watching. And the actors would freeze on the screen, but you could like kind of tell that they were still there. Like it wasn't like a screen, like a freeze frame. It was just the actors in the thing.
Yeah, there's some
Free.
actual creativity
It's
in that stuff,
awesome.
right? They're
That's
actually
cool.
doing something that will stimulate a
Yeah.
brain.
Yeah.
So,
So just coming back to your question, there's a couple of ways to think about it. Some just
like,
want.
tell me a successful one that you've got going, just so people have an example as you explain this.
So we have a couple of chiropractic doctors who teach other chiropractors how to run an effective business. It's called the Remarkable CEO, and they've been going on 3 years now, and they've got we they haven't missed an episode. They go every week, and it's the two of them talking, and they're essentially just best practices, all the things, because they've been in the trenches for 20, 30 years. So they teach, how to run an effective chiropractic office. They've got a mastermind group that meets that they charge an annual fee for. So what's happening is people are coming for the content. They realize these two guys, they know their stuff, and they just keep listening. They talk a lot in podcasting about know, like, and trust. And I think it's from an early marketing book. I don't know if it was Simon Sinek or one of those guys, but, and ideally, it happens in that order. So they have to know who you are. They have to like your content. And then they trust you because when you start offering stuff, then they naturally feel like they want more of your stuff. So yeah, they hear them. Hey, if you like this episode, then sign up for a free call with us. You can do a discovery call, something easy for them to take the next step. But you want to move them through the marketing funnel. And we essentially work with businesses that have something in place already, or one or two steps removed from putting something in place. You can ask for an email because that slows down the conversation. If you try to do too much at the end of a podcast, people get overwhelmed. Contrary to popular belief, people are not sitting there with a notebook listening to your episode, gleaning all the fantastic knowledge bombs you're dropping. And they're like, oh, yeah. So that's why we write show notes for clients so people can go back. But you want people to have one clear thing to do, ideally, at the end of each episode. Hey, did you like this? Go. Sign up for a 15-minute exploratory call. Go sign up on our email list, or go download this one-page PDF, like AKA like a lead magnet. So we're thinking about those things from day one when we're having conversations with clients. The other thing to do is there's a wide variety of formats. You can teach your best stuff, but you teach it at a high level. And something I learned from a previous one of my current coaches is you give them the what and the why for free, and they pay for the how. So a previous client, Carrie Granger, she's an executive coach specifically for C-level executives, and she calls her podcast episodes prescriptions. So when she's having calls with prospects, she'll say, hey, you know what, Dan, You're talking about accountability for your team. We actually covered that in season two. Go back and listen to episodes 3 and episodes 7 specifically about those topics. And then, you know, schedule a follow-up call with us. So the podcast is now doing the heavy lifting.
Yeah, you don't have to send them
repeated calls. Some folks do an internal podcast. They'll just talk about what's happening within their teams, and you can do a private feed, and you can just, instead of the letter from the CEO, it's the podcast from the CEO. And then lastly, another format that works really well is testimonials. So you get your best clients on and you interview them on the podcast, and you're like, hey, Dan, tell me, you know, it's a 4-part question. It's what were you struggling with before you even met? 2 is, what was it about our offer that went, or our services that made you want to work with us? 3, what's the result we've had since we've been working together? 4, what would you tell someone who's in your shoes a year ago? And as you might imagine, that is a pretty nice, sweet testimonial. And then you now have that as content. So you think about all those different ways. And then just from a repurposing perspective, some people don't like to write. Some people just like to talk, like myself. And so by virtue of you talking, by virtue of you creating solo content or interviews, we then repurpose that into what you see as a blog post, but we're embedding a media player on the site. We're linking to all the comments or the quote. We pull out quotes from the episode. Any links or resources mentioned, we're pulling those out as well. And so when people get to the site, now as a business owner, you have content coming out every single week, which we then not only improves the SEO value of your website because you have fresh content coming out every week, but then we actually repurpose that into marketing stuff as well. So we're creating graphics and audiograms, which is an animated movie with a snippet of the audio, and we're getting access to clients' accounts and we're promoting it on their behalf for them. So it becomes a bit of a content marketing machine, and all you have to do is record that content once.
Yeah, it's communication cannibalism. Like you're re-eating the same body over and over again in different places. I like it.
That's a nice way to put it.
Well, I've talked to a lot of people about this, like content. I was a writer. I was an English major as an undergrad. And then I moved over into speech comm because I like writing, but it's so much work and it's so unpleasant and it's so isolated. But speeches, getting up and talk, like when you do stand up, there's 200 people and they're kind of co-writing with you. Like they'll tell you where your material is flat. You know, instant response. I used to give essays and things like that to people and watch them read and laugh. And I'd always say, what are you laughing at? Because there's no pleasure unless I see what is hitting. So, you know, purposing content, like creating content as writing, then moving it over to stand up and then moving it like I do into one person shows, podcasts, all these things, you do get a sense that you've created a little, you know, galaxy of kinetic content, and you want to make use of that because it has value. So you want to go back in there and you just start hacking it up into, I can send this out in an email.
And it's also reflective of how people consume content, because I'll get stuff in my inbox and at podcasts, and this is what we train clients on sometimes, is they think they're doing too much. They're like, well, if I post it on Twitter and if I post it on Facebook and if I post it on LinkedIn and I send them an email, they're going to be like overwhelmed. I'm like, newsflash, like they're not sitting there monitoring their socials waiting for your episode notification to come out. Yeah. You'll be lucky if you catch it in an email. So just want to be visible where people are naturally. And some people only have a Twitter account, or some people don't have any socials and they're only on email. So just be everywhere so that if people are interested in your stuff, you know, they'll find the best way and they'll connect to the best way to get those updates from you.
One of the things I like about your perspective on a lot of this stuff is you've clearly worked in businesses for a long time, and you harvest a lot of your techniques and things from sort of marketing techniques and business friendly techniques. And even the theorists that you mention a lot of times are business writers and sort of business coaches and that kind of stuff. I've worked in entertainment, I've worked in rhetoric and stuff like in entertainment or in politics. Now I've been in politics for the last 5 years in some way or another. And in politics, when you see people running these same games, like they've got content, right, that they want to get out there, but they've got to, you know, either go through their social or even better, get it into the media. And I used to call it as the playing a bugle at the symphony, like, or bringing a electric guitar to the symphony. Like you are competing with everybody else for attention. So you have to do something that blares, and it doesn't matter if it's irritating or aggravating or problem causing or disruptive. In fact, that's good because now they're paying attention to you and they can't pay attention to all these other people. Businesses typically don't want to take that kind of strategy. You know, they're trying to stay within the seams of the universe instead of taking over the universe. But when you see something like Geico, Geico basically just went over and harvested animation, and it harvested some decent comedy writers, and that made it stand out in the advertising world. But it literally went outside of business to do that. It went and grabbed it from entertainment and actual comedy. Some of their early bits about, hey, it's like a, you know, bodybuilder at a, you know, traffic cop or whatever, you know, those are stand-up lines.
Yeah.
And so when I sometimes offer what my marketing agency does or when I do as a consultant is I harvest from other areas and bring them over to business so that they won't damage your business, you know, because there's some of them that are going to be damaging you want to stay away from, but you want to grab some of that uranium from these other areas and drag it over here so you can outcompete people who are standard practicing in business. That's one of my pitches.
I think the people that do it well understand and effectively mine the best from all these worlds and never look like askew at like, oh, this came from comedy or this came from like some marketing book from the 60s, just like understand the psychology about it. And that's why I thought your book was so interesting as well, but just because I always want to understand not only language, but also how people are interpreting language and phrases and visuals and media, because, you know, to the extent that you can harvest that or use that force for good is always a good thing, because there's a lot of people who are using it for bad. And we've talked about NLP as well, which is like, I'm going to fool you into thinking something that you didn't know you wanted to be thinking about. So,
yeah. And that's why, again, I like the theme of ethical only persuasion, just because everybody's been taught. There was something about the 70s with sort of subconscious subliminal advertising became popular in the 70s. And there was a book that came out and maybe a documentary about, oh, they're getting inside your subconscious and making you buy more burgers. And so everybody became very afraid of manipulation. And then like when the Nazis used propaganda, everybody became afraid of mass persuasion. And so persuasion itself has become a villain for people. And it's almost instant whenever somebody meets me and they start finding out what I do, they immediately want to turn me into a villain. Oh, you're going to manipulate me? I'm like, maybe, you know, are you susceptible? You need to defend yourself. This is your fault, not mine. But it's one of those things I try to rescue right away and say, no, persuasion is natural in the world. Mm-hmm. Everybody has to persuade everybody else. You might as well do it ethically and do it well and be able to defend yourself against the nefarious utilitarians out there. And so, you know, it's a good pitch again, but it's one of those things that, you know, getting sophisticated with this stuff versus using what people normally think, I think is the big offer of rhetoric. It's like, there's more sophisticated ways of thinking about this. And if you adopt some of those, you're going to be able to be much more effective in the normative world because they're not thinking in these ways. Yeah. So it gives you different strategies and tactics and so on.
You have to want to put in the work to learn communication at that level, though, because it's, you could take the easy way out and just like, I'm only going to learn enough to just get me through this conversation. But I think understanding, you know, where it started and how to be better at it, it's not easy work. But I've been fascinated by it recently. And just digging, the more you dig into it, it does become a bit of a rabbit hole.
Well, and ultimately, if you are looking for advantages, no matter where you're playing, then you want to put out, you know, super effort, not consumptive effort. Like consumption culture, Amazon, I can get this in 2 hours by hitting a button, mm-hmm. has taught you that there are easy paths to things. And there are not easy paths to knowledge. Sorry. There are not easy paths to skills and, you know, sort of in-depth intuitive thinking. Like those are hard things to get your brain to do. And so get ready to put out the super effort for things that are going to give you that reward, because there's super return. Like even this, I totally encourage anybody who's listening to this podcast to go check out Podcast Junkies, because I've now talked to you three times. We talked on Lunch Club, we talked here, and then we're talking here again in the recurring Nietzschean, you know, life will repeat endlessly.
This is number four.
Is it?
Well, yeah, we tried. This is the second time here. We spoke on Lunch Club, and then you came on Podcast Junkies.
That's right. So it's the myth of the eternal recurring podcast. We're going to be doing podcasts like this, Groundhog Day style. But every time I've talked to you, I've realized you've got deeper and deeper experience with this. And I can completely see why a business should take this pitch of hand it all over to Harry Duran and Podcast Junkies and let them turnkey this for you so that you get all this return, all that content across all these social platforms. That's a pretty good offer, man. I want it. Okay, I'm in.
Let's start. Yeah, we'll work on your program over the air, and we'll just do it live and just record those episodes too. I'm fascinated by how things are made. There's a really popular show called Startup, and it was the folks who started Gimlet Media, which is one of the early production companies, and how he was going and he was pitching himself to like Chris Sacco at Twitter, and he was recording it, and it was just incredibly awkward, but it was fascinating. Tape, as it's called, but it was just so great to hear like him thinking through like, oh, it's like we want to create a name, and they were coming up with names for the network, and fast forward a couple years ago they got bought by Spotify for a couple $100 million. So it's I love origin stories. I love hearing how
Origin stories. You don't hear nobody's jump on about their shitty origin stories where, yeah, we named it Gimlet, you know, Gimlidia, and nobody liked it. I've done a bunch of naming for the marketing agency. We had a company came in one time, and I love these guys. They're great software engineers. Like, their company's awesome, but their God, if I can even remember what it was called, their name was so bad that people laughed when they would hear it. Like, I'll have to look it up. I won't put it in the show notes because I don't have any show notes. It sounded like Mesopotamia, but it was even worse. And so I was like, how are you guys getting work? You must be really good. And they're like, yeah, nobody can spell our name or remember it or pronounce it. So we renamed them Solution Machine, which fits very well with what they do, because they solve anything with software.
That's good. I like that.
Let me see if I got to tell you what they're, you talk about something. I'll look this up real quick.
No, I think it's just, this idea for anyone interested in starting a podcast, if you're listening and this has piqued your interest, to just be specific about what you want to talk about and have it be something that you're passionate about, because it could be a slog. And, you know, throughout the 8 years, I've always felt like times when I wanted to quit and I'm just like, why am I doing this? But then comes full circle. I have great conversations with folks like Dan, and I really get reinvigorated, because if I want to be a better conversationalist, what better platform than one I've created already? And just try to get better with each conversation.
Yeah, I think that word sometimes, passion, you know, has been overused to the point where people pull back from it. Mesohanian, that's what they were. Mesohanian. It's like, what? Anyway, but it's really about this idea. If you have an enduring interest in something, like just an enduring curiosity. Yeah. And I tell people, when I talk about the aesthetics, if I were directing podcasts and helping people do it, is just follow what authentically interests you. Ask whatever occurs in your head of that just goes, hey, I wonder about this. And if you follow your authentic interest, typically you create good content, because that's what people at home were thinking about. They're like, I wonder what, you know, what. Oh, that's why I said, like, when you pull up exact examples, like the chiropractors and things like that, I think that brings it home about, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense. I would listen to that if I were a chiropractor.
Yeah.
So, well, awesome, man. Again, a good conversation. Hopefully it recorded. You know, this is the first time using the new computer, so God knows.
That's funny.
But
yeah. Thanks, Dan. I really appreciate it. And I think sometimes you overthink me as a guest coming back the second time. I didn't necessarily have to talk about the cool stuff I talked about last time, because it's almost like talking about time travel. Like, that conversation is somewhere floating around the ether somewhere.
Oh, I know exactly where it is. It's on a dead computer in my closet. If anybody wants to go recover the data, go for it.
But it is fun to think about just the stuff that you put out into the ether and just where it goes. So I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, I did a tweet the other day about, hey, for all those people who get nervous about their speeches or what they're saying in public, remember that 99.99999% of all speeches that have ever been given have been forgotten instantly and nobody has ever heard them. So
yeah, and just on that, and for folks that are thinking about getting started, you could record your first episode and just don't tell anyone. Like I tell them people all the time, like, because all podcasters hate the sound of their voice. It's just like, ah, I sound horrible. So just record it. Like literally don't tell anyone, don't tell any family members, don't tell your spouse, just record it and then just listen to it yourself and just keep doing that. And at some point you'll feel like sharing it with one person and you go from there.
Well, there you go. And if you have a business or you know somebody has a business might be interested in this, send them over to Podcast Junkies and Harry Duran because he will take care of them turnkey. He won't let them, and he'll cater to you. He'll bring martinis. It does it all, man.
Yeah, I created a link for folks specifically for your listeners. If you go to fullcast.co, which is the agency /Dan, we'll put a link. It's a game plan to help you get started with your podcast. It answers all the basic questions like what mic to use, where do I host? A lot of the get started questions that people trip over. So fullcast.co/Dan.
Cool. Well, that has been our Podcast Junkies episode. I think you should know every single thing about podcasts by now. If you don't have a successful podcast, it's clearly your fault. So go talk to Harry and he'll fix it all for you. This has been Rhetoric Warriors. Get out there and persuade people. They need it.
Oh, me. Thanks. Again.
What's that?
No, I said you're still recording. I don't know if you were going to end it there.
I was trying.